This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome to the 2011 Comparative Ethnic Studies Lecture Series. Excuse me while I kiss the sky, just as we cannot revel in Jimi Hendrix's lyric and not feel that connection between the kissing of the sky and the kissing of the ground. We simply cannot read Richard Eitens' In Search of the Black Fantastic without looking up and then looking right back down at the ground. We feel the reverberations of those words, hey, celestial, in Toni Morrison's novel, Love. Morrison writes, "And from then on to say amen or to acknowledge a particularly bold, smart, risky thing, they mimicked the voice crying, hey, celestial." After reading Richard Eitens' In Search of the Black Fantastic, Oxford 2008, I cry, hey, celestial. When graduate students want to understand the problematizing of the modern in African American studies, I tell them, In Search of the Black Fantastic, hey, celestial. When a colleague asks me, what's the best, the latest work theorizing the Black aesthetic? I tell her, In Search of the Black Fantastic, hey, celestial. When Houston Baker and I were recently wondering who at this moment is really speaking to the young scholars who are drawn to Black critical thought that produces space, as opposed to enclosing space, we both almost simultaneously said, In Search of the Black Fantastic, hey, celestial. Richard Eitens is professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Northwestern University. He is winner of the 2009 Ralph Bunche Award for In Search of the Black Fantastic, Oxford University Press, and the 2001 Gustavus Myers Outstanding Book Award and 2000 Best Book Award on the Social, Cultural, and Ideological Construction of Race from the American Political Science Association for Solidarity Blues, Race, Culture, and the American Left. He is now completing Ghost, Text, and Play, Politics Beyond the Boundary. The title of his talk today is Tricky Times and Liquid Spaces, Text, Play, and Diaspora. It is my sheer pleasure to welcome our speaker.
Okay, wow. There's no way I can match that extremely generous and inaccurate introduction. Hey, Celestia, wow, okay. I'm gonna steal that one. Thank you very much, Margot, for the invitation and equally for the introduction. This is being recorded, so I'm going to steal that at some point and put it on my website. Also, thanks to Karen Kudich for arranging my being here and all the details quite efficiently. I appreciated that quite a bit. And I'm going to try to get to 10% of that introduction, if I'm lucky, maybe 5%. And most of this is drawn from the book, and I have three epigraphs I want to start with. Three epigraphs. First is from Jacques Derrida, because you have to do someone French when you start a talk doing Black material. To deconstruct philosophy thus would be to think in the most faithful interior way the structured genealogy of philosophy's concepts, but at the same time to determine from a certain exterior that is unquantifiable or unnameable in philosophy what this history has been unable to simulate or forbid. By means of the simultaneously faithful and violent circulation between the inside and the outside of philosophy, there is produced a certain textual work. Second epigraph from Chocolate Genius. I am chasing strange. I will rearrange to be apart with every change that you make. And the third epigraph, last, from Grace Jones. Pull up to the bumper, baby, and drive it in between. Okay. It is a familiar dilemma. How do the excluded engage the apparently dominant order? Does progress entail that the marginalized accept mainstream norms and abandon transformative possibilities? These questions, of course, become more complicated once you recognize that the excluded are never simply excluded and that their marginalization reflects and determines the shape, texture, and boundaries of the dominant order and its associated privileged communities. The identities of the latter are inevitably defined in opposition to and as negation of the representations of the marginalized, and in certain respects, the outside is always inside, invisible, perhaps implicated and disempowered, unrecognized but omnipresent. In this context, how do the outcast imagine and calibrate progress and assess options? For subalterns generally, this outside-inside dynamic, the colonial dilemma, has often been experienced asymmetrically, as political disfranchisement on the one hand, and overemployment in the arenas of popular culture on the other. Accordingly, in trying to map out the most effective strategies for emancipation, blacks, for example, have had to try to understand the precise nature of the linkage between popular culture and this thing we call politics. What kinds of politics can cultural actors make if blacks, as it is commonly asserted, have a unique relationship with the cultural realm, a positioning that has been celebrated by some and cursed and refused by others? My aim here is to consider some aspects of this colonial dilemma with particular attention to the intersections of the state and diaspora, sound, vision, and formal politics. My sense is that after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the release 3 months later of Nelson Mandela, which marks, I would suggest, thinking broadly and globally, the end of the civil rights movement, and in a certain sense, the post-colonial shift, a certain nervousness with regard to the possibility of black difference reemerges. In this context, the philosopher Charles Taylor's take on alternative modernities finds a receptive audience among those struggling to articulate black ways of being or becoming, but lacking the ground or the energy to do so. I would also suggest that this turn, which is in many ways a return, is partly about an exhaustion with politics and a desire for the post-antagonistic and a sensibility detached from the agonistic. In this post-tactile context, black scholarship, not surprisingly, begins to arrange itself in such a way as to accommodate and leave untroubled the dominant ways of thinking about politics. It begins, in other words, to assimilate the values of the redacting state, what M.A. Césaire refers to as the forgetting machine. That is, both the sensibility which calls for, by means of a series of unpublished retractions, the recurrent desideration of colonial linkages and entanglements, and secondly, the dynamic and nervous text that is a nation state with its impulses to render all that is liquid as sedimented and solid and circumscribe considerations of alternative political possibilities and imaginations. To be precise, I'm thinking of this post-Berlin Wall, post-apartheid sensibility both literally as a way of being that emerges after a certain point in time and as a way of naming a dynamic or tendency that obviously predates late 1989 and early 1990. Accordingly, the referent 89-90 functions as a shorthand and points to a sublative tendency in black politics, a desire or willingness to assimilate or approximate dominant narratives energized paradoxically by an exhaustion with politics, or more precisely following Carl Schmitt, Ernesto Laclau, Chantal Mouffe, and Bonnie Honig, among others, the political. It is as a result of these types of dynamics, as Barnard Hesse has recently argued, for example, that we find ourselves bound inevitably and strangely committed, despite our dissonant viscera, to a post-racial horizon while still submerged in a matrix saturated with race, racial hierarchy, and racism. The grip of these teleologica and this desire not to be excluded from the community of the normal can translate in this context, I would argue, into an avoidance of struggle and the abandonment of transformative possibilities. The ambition to be included into mainstream spaces can necessitate accepting alienation and subordination as the price of the ticket, to use James Baldwin's term. It also means rejecting the belief that modernity, that bundle of cultural, political, philosophical, and technological iterations and reiterations of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the Industrial Revolution, requires an alterity, as Michel Rolfe-Trioux suggests, and it implies and requires antonymic and problematic others. If modernity lacks a thickly transformative dialectic within its matrix, for example, the Hegelian blueprint, if it is unable to shake itself free of its embedded sexism and racism, if it has a primal tendency to read issues that make race salient as pointing towards either the pre-modern or anti-modern, we should have doubts, I would argue, about the feasibility of any simplistic reconciliation of the modern and the black, however constructed, and the more superficial depictions of the Afro-modernity and Afro-modernism projects. If this understanding of modernity as a relation is valid, the labor that has been devoted to making the text of modernity self-evident and operational, and the commonsensical representations and exclusions that render civilization feasible need to be exposed and acknowledged. Accordingly, those actors committed to changing substantively the situation of blacks are required to make plain, to borrow from Achille Mbembe, modernity's capacity to legitimize the violence of its irrationality in the very name of reason. Also to contemplate abandoning any attachment to the rules of the game and to seek strategies and employ whatever means available that might destabilize and transcend the norms and assumptions underpinning the projects of modernity despite their attractiveness, ubiquity, and apparent inescapability. Among these understandings would be the privileging of the national that renders the modern nation state the paramount structural effect of the modern social world, as Timothy Mitchell has observed, natural, convenient, coherent, and appealing, and the fencing off of the aesthetic from the political. These two related concerns, relationships between art and formal politics and the nation state and diaspora, are the framing questions for the book In Search of the Black Fantastic, from which much of this talk is drawn. The complex of imperatives imposed on non-whites regarding economic function, cultural identity and sexuality, and civil status are constructions that those engaged by the discursive traditions and agenda that define black communities must recognize, resist through the circulation of competing narratives, and beyond that, hopefully transcend. We might also think here of the struggles to establish and maintain space for substantive, open-ended, deliberative activity, including but not limited to the nurturing of potentially subversive forms of interiority through and by which private geographies are made available to the public, such as Michel Ndejiocello or Richard Pryor, the support of comedy, writing, and music workshops, the classic Motown and Stax studio arrangements, Horace Tapscott's Pan-African People's Orchestra, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, the Comedy Act Theater in Los Angeles, the UCLA Film School in the 1970s, the UK-based Black Audio Film Collective, the Soulquarians based around Questlove and The Roots, and the Talking Loud Remix Network of the 1990s and early 2000s. Also the Black Press, the Black Political Convention Process, the band as a formation within black music, diaspora sensibilities and opportunities, soul architectures in general, and conceptual space within language itself. If modernity is about the imagining and making and remaking of dark objects outside of the range of reason and the discursive itself, the Black Fantastic might be understood partly as requiring the privileging of signs and symptoms of black deliberative processes. By bringing into view and into the field of play practices and ritual spaces that are often cast as being irrelevant and categorically besides the point, to the point indeed of being unrecognizable as politics, these visions might help us gain normative traction in an era characterized by the dismissal of any possibilities beyond the already existing. My concern is to identify the ways in which these sensibilities and activities in and around the joints of the politics popular culture matrix derive from a particular understanding of the relationship between blackness and modernity might transcend the prevailing notions of the aesthetic and the predominance of the state as a sole frame for subject formation and progressive and transformative discourse and mobilization. These perspectives and practices require then both overriding the aesthetic and decentering the state, i.e. thinking diasporically, and in the process pushing to the surface exactly those tensions and possibilities that are necessarily suppressed and denied in the standard respectability discourses associated with the preservation of the modern. It might be useful here to think of Jürgen Habermas's references in the philosophical discourse of modernity to dark and black thinkers. And he's making a distinction between those he considers to be dark and those he considers to be, quote unquote, black. And he thinks of dark thinkers as Machiavelli, Hobbes, and Marx, writers who think through the disharmonies with the modern project in a constructive way and ultimately remain within the field. In contrast, black writers like Nietzsche, the Marquis de Sade, Theodore Adorno and Max Horkheimer are engaged in what he calls various forms of obscenity. While I do not want to accord too much significance to Habermas's anxieties, although striking, telling, and amusing they might be, nor remain transfixed within his particular geographic philosophical imaginary, his distinction raises in a roundabout manner a way in which you might think about the fine arts of diaspora theoretically in relation to the dominant text and affiliated projects of modernity. As many have noted, part of the magic of the dominant narratives of modernity is their ability to render modernity and coloniality as unrelated matrices, to mask the common commitments that sustain biopolitics and necropolitics, biopolitics, Foucault and Agamben, and necropolitics, Mbembe, to beat the clock that reveals the temporal heritage shared by governmentalities and subordinativities, manage the symbiotics linking the prophylactic stake and its duppy extra text, and ghostwrite the productions, the co-productions of The Citizen and The Kaffir. One means by which these two realms, broadly speaking, the consensual and the coercive, might be brought together and various crucial pressure points made available is, of course, diaspora. If we think of diaspora as a form of aparenthesis, as a discursive, rediscursive, albeit agonistic field of play and possibility that rather than signifying social death, to borrow from Alander Patterson, you might think of it as a means of denaturalizing the modernity coloniality matrix and enabling transformative agency. There are two paths we can think about when we think about defining diaspora. I'm going to do one relatively briefly. The familiar set of narratives that center on the ruptures associated with the Atlantic slave trade and the Middle Passage. Notions of dispersal and discontinuity, this notion that diaspora happens outside of the African continent and it's a matter of either disowning Africa or returning to it and grasping it to the bosom, a framework that seems to argue that the possibility of going home is the dynamic or dominant narrative within the text of diaspora for those outside of quote-unquote Africa. Disowning and desiring Africa are not entirely dissimilar positions in that they depend upon an often static homeland cast either as magical or malignant and in need of quarantine. Both of these stances, I would argue, despite their normative incompatibility, reinforce colonial scripts in their common refusal to disarticulate place, gender, sexuality, and function, and engage Africa without quotation marks. And you can see this in the early 20th century pronouncements of Marcus Garvey. The historian Harvey Neptune, his work on the Trinidadian responses to American military presences in Trinidad before, during World War II and afterwards, also talks about the ways in which gender, place, and power get fixed with each other. And also you think about the songs of the Neville brothers, the song Africa, or D'Angelo's song called Africa, where you see this romantic notion where Africa does certain magical works. As the Neville brothers put it, take me on back to Africa, where a woman is a woman and a man is a man. In this light, following from Hazel Carby's Race Men and Michelle Stevens's Black Empire, it is useful to think through C.L.R. James's engagements with the hegemonic colonial scripts regarding gender, appropriate gender aspirations. As Carby reveals on the basis of readings of Minty Alley, The Black Jacobins, and Beyond a Boundary, in much of James's classical work, a certain masculinism is often detectable, an emphasis on men as agents and women, if visible, as passive and often associated with the masses. Accordingly, we might suggest that these gender commitments were reproduced in Elise's early diasporic thinking and practice, for example, his reading of Toussaint Louverture and his excitement about Paul Robeson as a political leader, following his casting of Robeson as Toussaint in the early theatrical rendering of The Black Jacobins in London, and also, if you read Beyond a Boundary, his particular attention to men's bodies in this text. We also see in the early James a vacillation between the two different narratives mentioned above, one that associates normative masculinity with intellectual work and middle-class status, thus explaining his decision to join the middle-class Maple Cricket Club rather than the lower-middle-class Shannon and the working-class Stingo, and also a distinct but complementary narrative that links masculinity with the physical and aesthetic work of the body. In other words, an internal debate regarding what kind of man should be on top. Moreover, moving beyond James's example, one could argue that these two narratives, one upholding an imagined civilization, the other an uncontaminated and doubly tropic hyper-masculinity, shift in relation to each other over the course of the 20th century. Specifically, as the century progresses, the willingness and capacity of New World blacks to identify the continent as a female space in need of guidance, custodianship, protection, or domination diminishes. While such discourses certainly persist at the end of this period, we can see this in D'Angelo's Africa again, the propensity to think of these diasporic engagements in straightforwardly hierarchical and gender terms with blacks outside of Africa in the dominant position lessens significantly after the confluence of events that precede and follow the 1945 Manchester Pan-African Congress in Manchester, and also when you think about the Ghanaian independence in 1957 being established, it's a transition taking place in the 1940s and 1950s where blacks in the Americas no longer can make the safe assumption that they will lead the diaspora and lead Africa, quote-unquote, lead her to freedom. It's also, you can refer back here to Harvey Neptune's work again in the conflict between African-American soldiers and Afro-Trinidadian males In the context of the American occupation, as speaking to a transition point in this relationship between blacks in the Americas, blacks in the Caribbean, which sort of operates as a midpoint, and African blacks in general. Such claims, I would argue, would not have been asserted, the kind of claims that Neptune is making about the power of African American men that they exercise over black men in other parts of the diaspora. Such power would not have been asserted or as easily made in a later period. To be sure, the standard conflation of the civilizationist narrative with specific conceptions of gender roles and normative sexuality certainly prevails beyond the midpoint of the 20th century. And the reading of the convenient African as a source of trepidation and anxiety as more than capable precedes 1945. Nevertheless, I would suggest that the relative salience of these mythologies changes over time with World War II. And here one might think of the diasporic negotiations in the area of comparative masculinities depicted in Ousmane Sembène's Camp de Tiroir, again the Manchester Pan-African Congress, and the leadership role played by continental Africans and West Indians in the movement towards independence in the post-war period. It is interesting in this context, following from Brent Edwards' work, to rethink the Negro Noir and African Antillean negotiations within the Negritude movement, and black Francophone discourse more generally as reflecting changing notions regarding the location of dispositive normative black masculinity. There's a possibility of a second starting point, a second way of thinking about diaspora, which is the one that I want to focus on for most of the rest of this talk. And this is sort of correlated to a basic first principle, the notion of the impossibility of settlement. And it's in contrast to thinking about diaspora as being key to the notion of when people settle elsewhere or when bodies move elsewhere, to think about the impossibility of settlement as a first principle in a way of thinking about diaspora, not just as a problem in itself, but as a possibility, as having perhaps these subversive generative possibilities out of this impossibility of settlement that could be extrapolated into and through forms of black politics. This approach to diaspora compels us to resist conceptual templates and metaphors that subsidize thinking in terms of seeds and stems, roots and roots, origins and elsewheres, and promote the problematic reification and detemporalization of Africa. Given the connections among the modernity, coloniality, race, and diaspora, it is crucial that we remain skeptical with regard to claims that the last of these terms can be understood without or outside an engagement with the Africa that is produced and reproduced by colonial and post-colonial structures and discourses. The forces that make and disrupt the virtual Africa and encourage blacks elsewhere to internalize stigmatized notions of the African are the same pressures that make settlement unavailable elsewhere and diasporize all within and without the continent. It is in this modern matrix of strange spaces, outside the state but within empire, that naturalization and citizenship are substantively unavailable regardless of geographical position. Approaching diaspora as aniformative impulse, in other words, that which resists hierarchy, hegemony, and administration, suggests a different orientation towards this dynamic. From this perspective, the primary focus is on deconstructing colonial sites and narratives and rearticulating them in ways that de-link geography and power. This would require a politics not reducible to the language of citizenship and governance, and accordingly allergic to the sensibilities underlying the national and to some extent the international and the transnational to the degree that they depend on and or reinscribe the nation state. Moreover, it would mean being suspicious of homeland narratives and indeed any authenticating geographies that demand fixity, hierarchy, and hegemony. Indeed, such impulses would mean rather than thinking of new, superficially dissident maps, we would have to think about a no-map sensibility that would make geography, if not an impossibility, extremely difficult. Conceiving of diaspora as aniform, we are encouraged then to put all space into play. One way in which diaspora functions as a form of insubordination is the possibility of rethinking the dominance of nation-state discourses and their attendant governmentalities and geo-orthodoxies. If the prophylactic state depends upon the exclusion of certain groups, their non-recognition as citizens, and the impossibility of their ever being members, diaspora provides a means by which these marginalizations and theographies can be recognized, contested, and following from Giorgio Agamben, profaned. The term geoheterodoxy can be applied to describe this diasporic potential, the capacity to imagine and operate simultaneously, faithfully, within, violently against, and outside the nation state. It is this ethical lack of commitment, this anarchist-inflected imagination, that enables subaltern subjects to push for inclusion among those protected by the prophylactic state, seeking, for example, equal access to the vote and citizen rights and comprehensive health care, while at the same time recognizing the limitations of this recognition, for example, remaining invested in other spatial registers, including the local and the diaspora. It's basically trying to get to the question that I started off working primarily in the area of public policy and trying to talk about achieving health care, generous income maintenance programs within the United States and other Western societies. And I've been asked a couple times by people who don't like me and my family, how do I correlate that interest in public policy within the state with my interest in diaspora and in some ways recontextualizing the state? And basically this notion of geoheterodoxy speaks to that seeking the rights, the benefits of citizenship is not inconsistent with also putting in place a certain value on other identifications, whether local, diasporic, transnational, whatever. That this notion of geoheterodoxy speaks to that it's not a zero-sum game. There's a range of identifications. And in a sense, from this perspective on diaspora, when we think about the state, part of the recontextualization is a desire to reduce the state to its bare essentials, strip it of its national anthem, strip it of its baseball teams, football teams, its celebrations, and reduce it to the basic provision of public goods, services, healthcare, and all the rest. Which obviously there'll be a struggle involved in that because a lot of people attach their national anthems, their World Cups, and their National Football League. But basically trying to, as part of an investment in this notion of diaspora, reading the state as a necessary arrangement for providing certain public goods, but not seen as the whole game or the final frontier, and trying to push back in some ways, recontextualize the state.
Okay.
So thinking across the labors of a number of individuals and movements, there is another diasporic practice, possibility, or potential that might make visible, perhaps more accurately legible and audible, the modernity-coloniality matrix by putting into view a range of discourses that separated from each other, disarticulated and experienced in red and struggled against in isolation, cannot be recognized, contested, and transcended. Here, I'm referring to the tendency to represent coloniality in the United States in the thinner grammars of race, Jim Crow, segregation, racism, and most unfortunately, race relations. In Brazil, as the benign operations of racial democracy. In the United Kingdom, as the matter of a colonial past, and increasingly, perhaps, as the United States, as a matter of race relations. In South Africa, as apartheid and India's caste, and to varying degrees in parts of Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean, as colonialism and neocolonialism. And in France and Canada, as those things that only happen elsewhere. The Pan-African Congresses in the first half of the 20th century, Claudia Jones, Paulette Nardal, C.L.R. James, that's my way of saying thank you, Lorraine Hansberry, the African Blood Brotherhood, Mahatma Gandhi, Wilfredo Lam, Aimé Césaire, Grace Jones, Bob Marley, Ousmane Sembène, Harry Belafonte, Lauryn Hill on her better days, and A Tribe Called Quest, among others, can be thought as of engaged in this trade. The practice in question might be described as juxtapositivity, the ability of individuals and movements operating within the spatial register that is the diaspora to put together the scattered pieces of the puzzle of coloniality in order that we might, as Walter Mignolo urges, read modernity and coloniality together as a single matrix and develop our critiques accordingly. As a result of engaging with and recognizing these different but similar practices, these individuals and movements have the potential to denaturalize or declassify coloniality. Those global meta understandings that prevail beyond the end of formal empire, such as the race gender matrix, hierarchical labor relations, and the panics and ensuing competition justified by narratives suggesting the inevitability of scarcity and the state as the most reliable procurer, defender, and organizer. Or, put differently, the means by which Europe imagines, makes, and manages itself and its others, the shifting processes through and by which identities are ascribed, hierarchically and spatially arranged, and consequently life options, choices, and life chances are determined and dictated. With regards to black musics, while it is tempting to describe the last 20 years as the hip-hop era, both within African-American popular culture and politics and the broader diaspora, one could make the case that house music, defined broadly in terms of its Chicago versions, its Detroit versions, its British versions, has played an equally important role in shaping and influencing contemporary black musical commitments especially if one pays attention to the house music fusions that have emerged in various parts of Africa, such as South Africa's Spoke Mathambo, South America, and Europe. One might also read the hip-hop house difference as a negotiation, not always friendly, over the gender, sexual, and political terms on which Black diasporic life would proceed. After the 89-90 narrative ending of politics, and again, Fukuyama might be useful here, one can detect a struggle between those impulses to render all Black texts and forms easily assimilated to national borders and the contending urges to delink place, race, gender, and sexuality, in other words, to confound geography and coloniality in pursuit of anaformality. In this context, American-derived forms of hip-hop in tandem with Jamaican dancehall templates have more often than not worked to normalize nationalist configurations of Black possibilities, even as these forms have been widely marketed and consumed. It has been interesting to observe these efforts to make Black text work solely for the nation, as well as the competing gestures towards more fluid and liquid Black politics. One of the more remarkable arrangements of the dominant diasporic discourses in this period is Adrian Thaw's, a.k.a. Tricky's, Recalibration of Public Enemies, Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos, from the album Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. The original recording, which is a vague but compelling retelling and recasting of the Attica prison riot story, draws links between the draft, the situation of Black prisoners in slavery, and the implications of quote-unquote not being a citizen. The plot involves Chuck D leading a group of prisoners to freedom after having taken a gun from a male correctional officer. In terms of its gender commitments, there are repeated references to the number of brothers Chuck is leading, and the only correctional officer who is shot or killed is a woman, as Chuck says, "I popped her twice," after she tries to escape. Black Steel is also a typical representation of Public Enemy's work in this period, during which the collective was trying to reorient its music so as to make it more acceptable to a Black audience, as defined by the market, in terms of this notion that black music could not include rock in the mid-1980s, and to some extent still in the present day, that if one is, quote-unquote, engaging with rock, one gets it from Coldplay or gets it from an indie group, and one does not get it from Black musical traditions or the broader Black musical archives. So the collective was trying to reorient its music so as to make it more acceptable to a Black audience, conventionally defined, by downplaying the rock elements prominently displayed on the group's first, largely unsuccessful album. Finally, just before Black Steel begins, Flavor Flav can be heard telling a live audience, presumably British, "Bass for Your Face, London," and indeed English audiences were early supporters of the group, in fact, signing on before Black American listeners expressed significant interest. As Chuck D recalls, "We always respected the British audience from London to Birmingham. Blacks there are either from the Caribbean or have African roots, and they were very receptive. It was actually harder to crack it here in the United States because people were still in the slave-like mentality. It still exists in England too, but they have their Caribbean roots, and it's in the back of their minds." I would probably question his characterizations there, but I'll leave that for another moment. It might also be useful here to think of Public Enemy's work and the work of the director Spike Lee as energized by a certain awareness that the liberationist narratives that sustained anti-colonial movements, including the civil rights movement and the civil rights struggle, were drawing down. In other words, that there was sort of a sense that it was a narrative that set in play after World War II, that it was coming to its end, to its conclusion in 1989, 1990, and that the post-racial horizon that Barner Hesse has talked about was reaching its completion point. And you can read, perhaps beneath the surface, if you look at Chuck's work, if you look at Spike Lee's work, which so defined the late 80s and early 90s that it was almost not the beginning of a new period, but the end of a certain period. That we don't have very many examples of people following through in Public Enemy's work within hip-hop. It's almost the last example of that type of work. And Spike Lee's movies almost mark the end of that type of, the beginning of Black independent film, but also the end of a certain approach to making Black film, despite the popularity of both Public Enemy and Spike Lee. So it's sort of a sense that it's difficult to maintain that kind of traction, that type of activity after 1990, after this notion that Black politics and politics in general is dead, history is over, and that liberalism defines all of our possibilities. There's a way in which then that both P.E. and Spike Lee don't survive the post-89-1990 transition intact, in a way which they quite quickly become, despite their intense popularity, if not sustained impact, anachronisms. Given the sentimental structure, Tricky's 1995 cover version constitutes an almost perfect supplement and arguably a response to Public Enemy's transatlantic call. A former member of the Bristol Collective Massive Attack, Tricky had launched a solo career in tandem with his partner and subsequent co-parent, Martina Topley Bird. In early promotional photos, the duo would restage the scene from the R&B group's Cameo Single Life video, with Thaws wearing a wedding dress and with smudged lipstick and makeup carelessly applied, and Martina Topley Bird wearing a tuxedo. On the Maxine Quay album, named after Thaws' deceased mother, Martina's voice would be mixed slightly higher in the mix than Tricky's, and as Alexander Rahelia has noted and observed, the vocal interplay between the two, between Tricky and Martina, worries the distinction between lead and background and female-male singer in several significant ways. Moreover, Rahelia notes that in its contrast to Chuck D's original particular stentorian inflections, Topley Bird's voice unearths the Americanness of the original. Musically, the Thaws Topley Bird rendition draws on a rock-punk energy in contrast to the R&B foundation that supports the Public Enemy recording, and one can speculate that Tricky's intention is to let loose precisely that which the American rap group felt compelled to suppress between his first and second albums. In other words, one can read Tricky's choice of aesthetic genres as an act almost of both profanation and restoration, a scraping away the coats of paint that were obscuring the original potentials of the original piece of art. Besides revealing the particularity of Chuck's geographic location, Topley Bird's re-signifying of a text as male-identified as the original Public Enemy version is deeply disruptive. While the Public Enemy version is anchored in sex by Chuck's lyrical attention to his murder of a female officer who tries to run away, and the pleasure he seems to derive from the act, his shooting her twice, in the second version of Black Steel, Topley Bird can be heard singing and repeating, "They cannot understand that I am a black man," and in general assuming the position and identifying with the anxieties that Chuck D takes and to which he gives voice, respectively. In this gesture, Topley Bird and Thaws, who can be heard on the track as well as in the background for the most part, mark politics, oppression, marginalization, and the attempts at emancipation as a matter engaging women and men, as a concern that exceeds local and national borders, and indeed all bordering projects. Roughly the same dynamics account for the deployment of Soul to Soul's Back to Life in Hype Williams' Belly as a background against which the film's main character is prepared to commit mayhem. And this is the scene at the beginning of Belly where the movie's main characters are about to commit mayhem. And if there's time, I will actually show it. But I actually think just having that screen is more interesting than anything I could say today. Roughly the same dynamics account for the deployment of Soul to Soul's Back to Life in Hype Williams' Belly as the background against which the film's main characters prepare to commit mayhem. In this setting, the song is supposed to be read as a marker of sound system culture, thus enabling the imagination articulation of a certain sense of dread and inherent danger. This is a reading, I would suggest, that runs largely against the grain of the song's powerful and provocative fusion of R&B lovers rock feminism and sound system masculinism. But much, if not all, of the structure of feeling underlying the original and undecidable text slides under the power of the particular set of visual images Williams uses to introduce the film. If the post-1989-1990 redacting state is sustained by a drive to create distinct and incommensurable black national texts and archives, Soul to Soul's productions represented an obvious target that needed to be dismantled and disarticulated. Williams's Belly then can be read as part of a broader urge to tear asunder those texts that destabilize more easily digestible black and national narratives. Where Tricky and Martina managed to realign Public Enemy's radical template against the grain, Belly, with its surplus of intense coloration and visual images, succeeds in winning one for the home side, I would suggest quite unfortunately, by trapping Back to Life within the death space of the nation where it can only signify in certain safe and convenient registers. You can also see the same thing happening in Teddy Riley's remix of Soul to Soul's Keep On Moving, which took place in 1990, the way in which Teddy Riley, and it's sort of a moment where Teddy Riley's New Jack Swing sound had been sort of dominant in the last 3 years of the 1980s leading into 1990, and then Soul to Soul came across in 1989, 1990, and sort of a contest between the two. When Riley's given Soul to Soul the remix, he almost tries to chop the text down in such a way that it becomes reinscribes and reinforces the power of his own narrative and way of making sound in contrast to Soul to Soul. He takes a lot of the elements that make Soul to Soul distinctive and the various fusions that are distinctive with Soul to Soul, and in some ways sublimates them or erases them. And you can read that sort of similar in some ways, that if Belly is a need to disarticulate Soul to Soul, you can see the same thing happening with Teddy Riley's remix of their music. It is useful in this context to consider the struggle over the presence that is Grace Mendoza, a.k.a. Grace Jones, the Jamaican-born, Syracuse, New York-raised preacher's daughter and model-turned-recording artist. Jones's early and mid-1980s productions with Time also contributed to, or more accurately were appropriated and recontextualized by another tradition centered on the notion of an almost mechanical and rather sterile, anti-sensual Caribbean hypersexuality. In a sense, if Jones's sensual labors threatened to disrupt a certain project in sexual and visual order, the restoration and reinforcement of that hegemony required that she specifically be interpolated, recast, and localized in order to diminish any residual effects and uproot possibly encoded traces of her example. This at times intriguing and engaging reconstruction of the archetypal Caribbean woman as omnivorous sexual machine became, of course, one of the building blocks of late 80s, early 90s dancehall culture. For example, Patra's Worker Man, with the lyrics, "I need a man with five furlongs," which, if you're not familiar with what a furlong is, it's quite a length, and Lady Saw Stab Up the Meat, and would be reflected to a lesser extent in the subsequent work of rap artists such as Lil' Kim, Foxy Brown, and Trina. The centrality of some of Jones's personae to late 20th century dancehall would be evidenced by the inclusion of a remake of My Jamaican Guy on the soundtrack of the 1997 film Dancehall Queen, featuring Jones in tandem with DJ Bouncy Killer, as her relevance to hip-hop was underscored by her guest appearance on Little Kim's Revolution on her 2000 release, The Notorious Kim. Most of these interpolations would involve flattening or domesticating Jones's potentials either as American or as Jamaican, and not the two together, as either simply a convenient icon for nationalist productions, for example, Dancehall Queen, or a somewhat imaginative sex worker in the case of Little Kim. And I'll just note, I don't know what to do with Nicki Minaj in this context. I was trying to think about what I could say, but I think you could probably say something more interesting and insightful than I could at this moment. Jones's border straddling persona, perceived androgyny, and gender-transcendent box-top haircut in the early 1980s, for example, in 1981's Walking in the Rain, she speaks of feeling like a woman and looking like a man, stood in partial contrast to the images that African-American pop culture had imported from the Caribbean and exposed some of the sexual ambivalence, homophobia, and homoeroticism at the heart of contemporary African-American popular culture. Her fusions of Afro-Latin carnival and Afro-Protestant sound system cultures constituted a challenge to the more problematically gendered narratives of black political possibility and the complicity of mechanical modern blacknesses with the naturalization of national boundaries. As Beninese keyboardist Wally Badaru recalls, the Compass Point All-Stars is the group that Chris Brackwell assembled in Compass Point, Bahamas, to record a number of records for Island Records, first found their sound and identity working on Jones's Warm Leatherette album. As Badaru says, defiance was definitely there at the beginning, talking about the ensemble that featured Robbie Shakespeare and Sly Dunbar, the Jamaican drum and bass duo, percussionist Uzziah Sticky Thompson, Manchester, UK native Barry Reynolds on guitar, along with the Jamaican Mikey Chung. Continuing, Badaru says, "We didn't really know what was expected from us. Reggae? Not reggae? It turned out we were there to create something new. From the time we laid basic tracks for Grace's cover of The Pretender's Private Life, there were smiles on everybody's faces. There was a je ne sais quoi right from the time we laid down the rhythm tracks. We instantly knew something serious was being achieved. It was all about the groove, the sound, Grace's alternative voiceover, and low-key singing." Jones, for her part, would describe the band as being like the United Nations in the studio and describe herself as a foreigner. On another level, one can read her literal and figurative command to pull up to the bumper and drive it in between as sharing a family resemblance with Toni Morrison and Sadia Hartman's respective dissertations on the impossibilities of redemption and emancipation, with Lee Perry's and King Tubby's dub Exoskeletons vis-a-vis the narrative authority and autonomy of the lead vocal, John Coltrane's and post-bebop's rendering of show tunes and pop standards, and Jacques Derrida's deconstructions of Europe and philosophy. The marking and unsettling of boundaries, the evidence of aparenthetical dynamics common to these various sensibilities and strategies, represents ways of thinking with and against the dominant narrations of post-1989-1990 life, and as such are particularly vulnerable to derision, caricature, and dismemberment given their resistance to the dominant in archives and archivability. It is perhaps not surprising then that Jones and Tricky collaborated in the late 1990s on recording Hurricane, Cradle to the Grave, with the lyric chorus, I'll Be a Hurricane Ripping Up Trees, which was released in 1998 as a 12-inch white label, though did not appear on an album until recently, 2009. As a result of differences between Tricky and Grace Jones, they could not agree on the shape of the project on which the song would occur. But one can imagine that at least in the late 1990s, when they could see these attempts to reinscribe them or dismantle them or dismember them and fix them into national context, that they saw each other at least temporarily as kindred souls pushing and imagining against the grain. I'm trying to think, and here I'm moving towards my conclusion, I'm trying to think in the project that I'm working on now about the relationship between black politics, sound, vision, and texture. More specifically, if modern narratives equate citizenship with the right to speak and be seen, and prefer a certain arrangement of sounds, visions, and textures, it is to be expected, perhaps, that once excluded populations are superficially included, as happens with the post-colonial transitions, including the post-civil rights turn, that they will seek the right to make as much noise and to be seen as clearly and as often as possible as normative citizens. Indeed, the dominant narratives, one might suggest, will require the formerly subaltern to make more noise, to desperately seek the camera as a celebration and recognition of their supposed emancipation. Against these expectations and following in the paths laid out by Fred Moten and Lauren Merlant, those engaged by the project associated with the disinterring of the political, as opposed to mere politics, might consider the potentials associated with the anarrangement or deorchestration, anarrangement being Moten, deorchestration being Berland, of the assumptions and norms of modern politics. If the expectation is noise and the commitment to visual ubiquity, a deeply radical politics might urge humility, intentional silence, and invisibility as a means of confusing politics and revealing demands and imperatives underlying the Habermasian model. I'm thinking here, for example, of the use of space and silence in the musical works of Shirley Horn, Ahmad Jamal, and Miles Davis, the use of silence in Erykah Badu's video for Window Seat and Charles Lane's 1989 film Sidewalk Stories. My concerns are also driven, I must should admit, by a certain nostalgia for pre-video era music and a personal, visceral disinterest in not having to see music, but having to work through someone else's notion of what I should see before I can perceive it for myself. I like the idea of humility and modesty in formal politics and the arts in contrast with the desire to fill every channel with data. And I have here in parentheses, I need, I suspect, to get over this. I mention this here because in thinking about Grace Jones's example, where we can see particularly in her imaging exactly the sorts of visual commitments a sober anti-status quo politics might not celebrate. For example, the colors, the provocative excess, the Josephine Bakerish aesthetic, I'm starting to think that perhaps the issue is not the pursuit of a certain setting of the visual, audio, and tactile levels, but rather a refusal to assimilate any particular pattern. Noise today, silence tomorrow, visual surplus there, with potential and deep absence at any moment. In other words, following the logic of thinking of diaspora as aniformative impulse, and of black politics, or the substantively post-colonial, as anarrangement and aniformality, it might not be a matter of deliberate sensory general strikes, but rather the possibility that any of the channels or registers might be flooded, invaded, or abandoned at any moment. Deorchestration, then, not as reorchestration, through a commitment to silence or invisibility per se, but rather as a reflexive and deliberate strategy according to which various confounding options are alternately and randomly chosen. And this, in a sense, was and still is Grace, and potentially a certain dynamic potential within diaspora, productive, unpredictable, and generative obscenity.
Because of your work, you studied public policy and the other work you're doing. It seems to me if you open the frame really wide to look at Obama in relation to a kind of larger colonial project, I read him as a neocolonial leader. How would you respond to that?
Neocolonial in the sense that he is an instrument by which the colonial remains in place to a
degree. Yes, absolutely. That's one.
Yeah. I wouldn't disagree. I have this thing where I'm deliberately, I was lucky that the last book came out when I was doing the last proofs. I knew what was going to happen, but I chose deliberately not to live in Chicago. I gave money to the campaign like everybody else at Northwestern. But I deliberately didn't want to mention Obama. One, because part of me was thinking the whole world's going to change. And then my other voice, the wise voice, said nothing's going to change.
Right.
And I think there's a way in which, so I deliberately chose not to say much about Obama in that book. And in the project I'm working now, I'm thinking about not mentioning his name at all.
Oh.
Simply because, one, I know millions of friends who are writing books about Obama.
Oh, okay.
And two, because I think there's a way in which he is so intensely relevant and intensely irrelevant to black politics.
Yeah.
That it's like the tar baby. If I start talking about him, that's all I'm going to talk about,
right.
And that's the end of discussion of black politics, and that by not talking about him is a better way to not privilege his example or his, you know, that New York Times magazine story a couple years ago where, you know, it was Obama, the end of black politics.
Yeah.
At some point, I'll end up engaging with that narrative, and I don't want to engage with that narrative.
Right. I'm not so much concerned about him as much as the problematic of framing it in terms of a colonial issue, because people never apply that discourse when you think of U.S. And you mentioned Mignolo and a few other people who are talking about coloniality and its formation, in its representation in the U.S. as, and then, I mean, given, you know, recent work on Malcolm X, it will be interesting to see how all of that comes together. I think a lot of nice work is going to come out in the next few years because of all of these pieces. But it seems to me that problematic of the black, you know, the so-called black, you know, nation, if you will, I don't know if I should go there, in the U.S., is somehow still framed within that colonial discourse, given Malcolm X going to the U.N., you know, given we charged genocide, given Katrina, given all the evidence we have of how black subjects are treated as non-citizens in the U.S., and he himself. So, there's no birth certificate and all that. So, to me, we need a new kind of analysis that really brings back some of those questions. Or somebody was saying, I think in class, it is neo-imperial even, probably not even. If not neo-colonial.
I'm teaching a graduate course in post-colonial studies, so this week we're reading Césaire, C.L.R. James' Beyond a Boundary, and Said's Cultural Imperialism. Obviously not all the texts, but chapters from those three texts. And what's interesting, as you mentioned Malcolm too, is that really up through the 1950s, when folks talked about the civil rights movement, when they were talking about whether from inside the United States or outside the United States, or people start talking about post-colonial studies, the United States is always in the frame. But for some reason, we can guess quite quickly, it drops out. So you get this literature now where the post-colonial seems to talk about anything but the United States. And then the African-American civil rights literature or African-American studies literature is very much based with the United States. Some of the people that I didn't mention explicitly at the beginning, when I think about work of folks like Tommy Shelby, Eddie Gloud, Danielle Allen, who work within modes and within frames that are very much safely within mainstream discourse, pragmatism, American liberalism. And there's a way in which it's almost a fear to engage, not things that we have to imagine very strongly that are out there, but things that are already on the table, that people had on the table right up through the 1970s. But now we act as if there's only been the straight, narrow, you know, we read Du Bois, only talk to the United States, and everything remains very much within the frame of the nation. Obama presented the possibility of troubling that. He's very careful, he doesn't want to trouble that, because he wants to be reelected, and I don't know what else he wants, but he wants to be reelected, that's clear. And that's, in my view, not a bad thing, but, because the alternative is, you know, well, Haley Barbour or something.
Of not having the language to talk about anything.
I think we, and sometimes when I say this, I always try to frame it in a way that I'm not U.S. bashing, because I can make the same story about my homeland, which is Canada, or I can talk about Jamaica, where my mother comes from, that we, or Britain, where I follow a lot of the British discourse, or Black British discourse in popular media and radio, is that it seems that if diaspora requires a certain investment over and above the daily commitment and work that we have to do, that we are tired right now, and we just don't have the energy to tap into that imagination that would get us out of our national frames. So now we want to articulate a Black Canadian way of being. We want to talk about a Jamaican nationality that's extremely problematic on the ground and the way that's exported. An American, Black American nationality that just doesn't imagine itself outside. It doesn't even go to Hawaii or Alaska, I mean, because we're not supposed to go there. We can't find birth certificates. So these national Blacknesses that are operating in a way that it's frightening, because it's almost as if we don't recognize that the state has been an anti-Black mechanism going back 500 years. So that at best this is something that we have to deal with as a necessary evil, but to celebrate it or accept it and naturalize it is a scary thing. And Obama prevents an opportunity to do that, but has not been used for that, and himself has not put himself forward to play that role, for obvious reasons. He's marked as foreign enough, and he doesn't want to re-inscribe that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the talk. So I totally understand that you're telling us that deorchestration would not be that commitment to silence or invisibility, and yet you make me want to know how this tricky and more fluid racial politics, how would it sometimes pivot on silence or invisibility?
Right. Exactly as you put it, is that, because again, part of this is just, when I was coming to the end of this paper, I was having to deal with some of my viscera. I really am a fan of, I don't like visual images. And ironically, a lot of my best friends are filmmakers and art historians. And they don't need music in their house, they just want image. Well, the filmmakers need sound, but the art historians, they just image. I'm quite the opposite. I don't like consuming my image through my eyes, it's through my ears, or I touch it, or I create my own images. So because Fred came and gave a talk a couple of weeks ago at Northwestern, Lauren Belong gave a talk earlier this quarter, and Berlon was talking about this notion of, you know, ambient citizenship, and this notion of selectively choosing to be silent. And silence is an option, it's disrupting the orchestration of politics. Politics suggests that citizens make a certain noise, that they're asked to make certain noise at certain times, and that disruptive politics would break that connection, which I found incredibly powerful and seductive. And then I think, you know, Miles, think about Shirley Horn, think about Erykah Badu's, that's end of Window Seat, where that silence happens at the key point in the video. And Sidewalk Stories, Charles Lane's movie, which unfortunately, I just can't find it. I saw it in the theater, and I'm just recalling it because it's not available on VHS, it's not available on DVD. It seems, I'm sure people have it somewhere in some library, but I can't find it. But it's a silent picture until the last 5 minutes of it. It's a very powerful film. But then I was thinking about Grace, and Grace is not a silent actor. And she's productively not a silent actor. I mean, there's a way in which, here I'm not just thinking about sound, I'm also thinking about the visual. I mean, her cooperations with her earlier partner, Jean-Paul Goud, were just, they were over the top, but in a very productive way. And it goes to my ambivalence about these things. I mean, Josephine Baker, I have an ambivalence about these types of presentations and performances. But there's a way in which it made me think that it's not about just silence or being selectively invisible, because that itself becomes a fixed narrative and a sedimented way of being. It's about always being very sensitive, being reflexive about the way that you engage with the expectations of citizenship around sound, around vision, around tactility. Because the whole notion is, you know, that slaves, the definition of slave is someone who cannot speak. So then naturally our response to that then is that once we get citizenship, once we get freedom, emancipation, and all apologies to Cynthia Hartman to suggest that we ever do get that, then the notion is that we should speak as much as possible, because you never know when the mic is going to go off and we don't have anything to say. So that type of rush to be citizens by being available, visual, loud, and all the rest, I understand it, but at the same time, it becomes itself an orchestration. It becomes very, folds in very neatly to the notion, well, now we have them because they're operating on the terrain in the terms that we expect them to. So it's the ability to be reflexive and to change one's options at a moment's notice that I started to think might be the way to go. So I'm really trying to think about this now as I work on the next project, where I thought I was simply going to go towards, you know, this notion of deorchestration and an arrangement, just removal from some of the dominant ways of being, and how to think more in a more nuanced fashion about it. It can't be just a simply refusing something, reinscribed in some ways, the dominant narrative. So try to think about more creative, productive ways of doing that. And grace helps.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the definition of diaspora that you put forward, that you've described as the impossibility of settlement, mm-hmm. and that you've identified also with a certain black politics. How would you distinguish, or would you be interested in distinguishing the impossibility of settlement as an experience of modernity on the one hand, and something that's particularly related to black politics? If somebody wanted to appropriate your term. Mm-hmm. How would you stop?
As an experience of modernity.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's exactly because, I mean, I'll do a little background. A colleague of mine at Northwestern, Suleiman Bashir Diagne, who's now at Columbia, Senegalese philosopher, as they say, in the Academy of Star. We were doing this conference on diaspora, and there was always this notion on the table that diaspora was something that did not include Africans. And then he said, quite suggestively, that he always felt diasporized, and that the question was not one of physical movement, but rather of being shaken by and disturbed, even while you're not physically moved from the place that you are. There's a way in which diaspora is about the colonial experience, and not necessarily simply about on the Middle Passage or actual physical movement of bodies. It's just this notion of unsettlement. And it went very much against a lot of the narratives of diaspora, where diaspora is when people settle. Diaspora happens when you move to a certain place and you find people in England or Brazil or whatever the case might be, and that is diaspora. And it ended up at a conference where someone offered the definition that diaspora happens when people settle elsewhere. And I said, well, that goes directly against this other way of thinking about diaspora. Now, two of the useful aspects of that is, one, if you think about diaspora as the impossibility of settlement, it also leads to the notion that perhaps you could think about diaspora as the illegitimacy of settlement, that the land claims that are often attendant to the settler notion of diaspora are problematic. And if you treat impossibility of settlement as your first principle, then you can't make these kinds of settler claims that the land is ours or should become ours, that the people who are on the land around that. So it goes against the whole John Lockean notion that land becomes yours when you invest a certain amount of labor in it or you stand on that land. And secondly, it speaks to, as you know, to the modern condition. If modernity is about, I mean, the trump card in thinking about unsettlement to modernity is to think about quote-unquote Africa. But Africa is really simply the canary in the coal mine, to borrow from Lonnie Guinier. I mean, modernity is about perpetual unsettlement for all of us. And we all get renamed, reinscribed, tossed into the washing machine, tossed into the dryer, tossed on the floor again to be dirty again. And in that context, if we accept that and recognize the painful aspects and the pleasurable aspects and possibilities that fall out of that, it's a way of being sort of on the cusp of modernity, on the vanguard of modernity. Let me take that back. It's a way of dealing with the aspects and dimensions of modernity in a way that might not get us past it, but get us to approach its needs, its appetites, its needs for hierarchy in a different way, to be more critical in our engagement with modern narratives.
And it seems to hold a great deal of the effective for you in terms of this definition. No, I mean, what you've been describing, I mean, how do you deal with these particular situations?
Yeah. No, even last week, a colleague who was teaching a couple of chapters from the book in her class was telling me, well, this is all about you. I hadn't realized it was that clear. But as someone who's not really rooted in any, who's rooted in many places and doesn't privilege any of them, and is particularly resistant to national identifications of any sort, yeah. Anybody want to volunteer a narrative of how we think about Nicki Minaj? Because I'm a little too old to do her justice.
Join me again in thanking our speaker, and we also have a reception on the second floor.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.